closing argument. Walter Hudson. Pursuing happiness thoughtfully. 8 to 10 weeknights on Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
All right, we're going to be going to a break real quick here, the way things timed out. So let me just tease you with what's coming tonight. First of all, downstairs right now as we speak, Xavier Bickett, president of the Republican Liberty Caucus, is in the house, ready to come in here, give us his libertarian perspective. And unbeknownst to him, it's actually well-timed because there's a piece that made its way to my attention over the weekend from a place called Spectator. And the headline is, Why Libertarians Are Wrong. And it's particularly fascinating. We'll get into that next hour. Between now and then, I want to talk with Xavier about his activism, his outreach to the NAACP and to urban communities and the black community. That's something that's been a passion of his. And I have a number of stories here that, of course, are relevant to that. Of course, you know, the Jussie Smollett case. We're going to talk about that. And also the this guy, Fairfax, who's under fire in Virginia for alleged sexual misconduct, comparing himself to lynching victims. Is that legitimate? Spoiler alert, it's not. We'll get into it with Xavier when we return. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. You'd think, starting a half hour later than usual, we'd be on the ball and ready to go, but we're scrambling at the last minute here to get things together with Xavier Bickett in studio. Getting everything plugged in and ready.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here, man.
It was just a walk. I'm like, what are you doing tonight? Do you have anyone on?
Yeah.
Have an NAACP meeting. I can swing by. My kid will be in bed.
Sure.
I don't have no curfew.
No, we run a plug and play show here. You know, when it comes to Xavier, he can just drop on in and plug himself in on a moment's notice. That's totally fine with us. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights, generally, on Mondays. It's a little bit later with the Hockey Coaches Show during the hockey season. You can join us at 651-989-5855. Brianne in producing the show, taking your calls for the vacationing. Brad, he's going to be out for a couple of weeks yet. So, Xavier, you are coming from a shindig involving the NAACP. Is that correct? Did I read your text correctly?
Yeah, it was. It was the NAACP Political Action Committee. So I sit on a few committees. One is the Criminal Justice Committee, and the other one was the Political Action Committee. And I met a gentleman, Ian, who's the Civic Engagement Director of the DFL. So that was interesting.
Really?
And, you know, usually when I go to some of these meetings, they're like, okay, one, you're a white guy and you're a Republican here. You know, what's up with that? And I'm like, why don't we have a Republican staff member or someone at the party going to these meetings, engaging, you know, and instead of complaining about it, I just do something about it.
So how does that, I mean, how was it?
It was good. It was really good. It was our first one of the year. We talked about kind of some things that we need to, what we want to work toward and accomplish, you know, for the advancement of, you know, the black community or people of color. And I can't get into too many details because some of it is private, you know. But
just the sense of, because I think when, if you were to ask somebody, the proverbial conservative on the street, why isn't there that party engagement that you're talking about whereby some representative of the Republican Party as part of the NAACP Political Action Committee, the immediate response you would probably get is stunned silence and you know, this look of, are you serious? Is this a question I'm supposed to answer? Which is kind of where I was at about 5 seconds ago.
Sure, sure.
But what sense do you, or let me start with the question of, what is it that you're trying to achieve by engaging? And then also, what's the sense that you have that you're going to be able to achieve whatever that goal is?
Sure. So the whole point was, I, you know, as I had said, I don't remember how many, a month ago or so, is that I noticed a lack of Republican Party leadership engagement with the inner city on a consistent basis, developing relationships, not necessarily to say you need to vote Republican, but first we have to listen. What are the issues that are important to you? Now, I'm looking through a liberty lens, right? A libertarian lens as chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus. That's the hat, the title I wear when I walk in. And I try to, I want to work together with them on a lot of liberty issues, criminal justice reform issues, type of issues, and providing access for them and their concerns to the Republican Senate. Because right now the Democrats control the House, they control the governorship. So any bill moving forward, like the NAACP is looking to push, like criminal justice bills, it gets halt in the Senate. Actually, in the Public Safety Committee, Senator Warren Limmer, who I actually met with last week. So that's what I'm trying to achieve. And I've been welcomed with open arms, to be honest, and constantly saying, thank you again for being here. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad the Republican Party is, you know, trying to be a part of it, because NAACP is not politically oriented in any party in any way whatsoever. They are nonpartisan for the advancement of their goals that they're trying to achieve.
All right, so let me completely undermine the progress you're trying to make by throwing you under the bus here with some issues relevant to the Black community. This is stuff that I was going to talk about. I mean, this is what happens when you plug and play into the
show. I know,
show.
I just throw a show.
Yeah, I didn't prep any of these articles around you coming in, but it just so happens that some of the stuff has to do specifically with concerns raised by the Black community. There's a piece here at the Federalist. The headline is "Study Finds Voter ID Requirements Don't Repress Minority Votes." And of course, we're used to, you know, here in this state, going back to 2012, we had the ballot question that, if it had passed, would have amended the Constitution to require a photo ID in order to vote. And one of, if not the chief arguments against that, was that you're going to somehow disenfranchise minority communities. And right up there at the top of the minority community totem pole, the hierarchy of intersectional authority is the Black community that's going to be disenfranchised by this. Well, according to this work here done at the Federalist, voter ID requirements do not affect voter turnout, according to a new working paper published by the National Bureau of Economic Research. The researchers looked at 1.3 billion data points on U.S. voters from 2008 to 2013, and they found that the laws have no negative effect on registration or turnout overall, or for any group defined by race, gender, age, or party affiliation. Now, this strikes me as being kind of a duh-type revelation. Of course we know this, right? You know why we know this? Because everybody has an ID. Like, this whole narrative that they raised in 2012, and that's always raised whenever we talk about voter ID or voter issues, of, oh, people don't have access to an ID. Who are these people? I've never met one. I would love to. I want to meet the person who A, doesn't have an ID, B, has no capacity to get one. Like, what is your story that you have time to have a conversation with me about it, but you haven't been able to figure out how to get it done? Or, and if it's an issue of like some sort of genuine disability, then don't we have people and programs and things in place to provide people with the support they need in order to be able to move forward with it? So it's just always struck me as a disingenuous argument.
Well, actually, it's funny. We talked about some kind of form of voter ID today at this political action committee, because I'm working, the Republican Liberty Caucus and NAACP and many other coalition partners are working on something called Restore the Vote, which is restoring voting rights to felons who are no longer incarcerated. So they're out of jail, but still in papers, which is like probation. And so they're still serving their time. And you know, I'm trying to help get some Republican senators or maybe supportive of this. And I heard, I can't name names of who these people are, but I heard one person offer an interesting compromise for Restore the Vote, which is restore the vote in exchange for voter ID.
That's a I would take that.
I was like, wow, that's, you know, so I brought that up today and it didn't get any leg work at all. But I thought this is, you know, it's a compromise, right? And I thought it'd be a fair compromise. Now, for me, you know, when you said you're here to like deflate my bubble, or I don't remember how you opened this.
Throw
me under the bus. So when I go to the NAACP meetings, I mean, there are going to be things I disagree with them on.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to their meetings to say, here's where you're wrong.
Well, sure.
You know, I'm really there to try and listen first, understand what the concerns are and what issues are important to them, and then through my libertarian lens is where can we come together at?
Right.
Because one, we're trying to build bridges here, and to be welcoming, it's like I have to go ride for them. I got to go right. fight for them on something to build some goodwill. But this voter ID issue is brought up as a compromise for Restore the Vote, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but I thought it was an interesting compromise I never thought about before.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because, I mean, you and I both support the restoration of the vote to people who have felony convictions, who have re-entered the community. They're not in prison.
Correct.
They're out. They're in the workforce. They're paying taxes. They're part of the community. That is something that, from a libertarian perspective, just should happen.
And there's more than just that on a philosophical level. Just the way the criminal justice system has been set up, where maybe someone who has committed a crime or a felony, and maybe they are innocent, but they'll plead guilty. And just by pleading guilty, it keeps them out of jail, but they may be on probation for like 20 years instead of 10 years of being in prison. Or
right.
instead of going to jail for 3 years, well, now you're on 10 years probation. But you can't vote for 10 years.
Right.
And so what I'm working on with them is some probation reform. And I can't go into too many details on what those bills are and some things, but that, you know, I'm trying to work with some Republican legislators, specifically in the Senate and even in the House, of where's the compromise? Can we find some probation reform that may lead to maybe not having like double the probation time in exchange for the jail time, you know? So that's what I'm working on.
All right, before we dive into the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, I think we're going to have to go to the break because we're not going to be able to cover it in the amount of time that we have. But I want to touch upon this, and I still haven't figured out how his name's supposed to be pronounced because I don't watch TV and don't hear it pronounced. But Jussie Smollett.
Yeah,
okay?
That's so bad.
This character, I talked about a little bit last week about, you know, what set of values or priorities, where does the idea come from? That I'm going to fake a hate crime today. Not only am I going to do it, but I'm going to plan it out. I'm going to, what's that word? Collude. I wanted to use exactly collude. I'm going to collude with a couple other guys in order to create this fake scenario and try to pass myself off as a victim. Where does that even come from? And we talked about that a little bit last week, but there's a piece in National Review from Jonah Goldberg where he has a hot take on it that I think is very apropos, and I'd like to bounce it off you as well.
Sure.
Xavier Bickett, who is the president of the Republican Liberty Caucus in Minnesota. He's in here tonight with us to help us break down the news on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Twin Cities News Talk. All right, we were going to talk about the Jussie Smollett case, and totally coincidentally, you can't make this stuff up, man. During the break, I came across this piece by the Daily Caller. Let's look at what the headline was here. Transgender activist accused of burning down own home in hate crime hoax.
This is so bad.
Seriously.
2019, everybody.
If you were trying to put together a hoax of a hate crime hoax, you couldn't come up with a more ridiculous headline than transgender activist accused of burning down own home in hate crime hoax. Yet this is a real thing that we're actually looking at. The police have reportedly arrested a Jackson, Michigan transgender and gay rights activist for allegedly burning down his own home. Authorities accuse Nikki Jolie, who organized a series of pro-LGBTQ events and initiatives in the socially conservative town, of intentionally setting fire to their own residence. That's an interesting pronoun choice there. In 2017, the Detroit News reported Monday, 5 pets perished in the inferno, and the FBI investigated the incident as a hate crime, given that Julie had allegedly received threats prior to the fire, and goes on and on and on. But, you know, a hoax. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. In studio with us, Xavier Bickett, the president, chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus of Minnesota. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for letting me sneak in.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming in. So I wanted to get your take on this piece by Jonah Goldberg over at National Review. He writes regarding the Jussie Smollett case, another hoax, another hate crime hoax. And he kind of sets the stage in similar fashion to how we talked about it last week. He says, here's something you might not know. In Nazi Germany, very few Jews staged bogus hate crimes against themselves. Here's some more trivia. Very few blacks in the Jim Crow South went to great lengths to pretend that they were harassed or attacked by racists. You know why? Because that would be incredibly stupid. What exactly would the German Jew who staged an assault on himself gain from it? Where would he or she go to ask for sympathy or recompense? Conjure any horror story you like. The Nazi official you brought it to would say, yeah, and? The black sharecropper who took the time to make his own cross and burn it on his own property would benefit. How? Why am I bringing this up? Well, for a bunch of reasons. First, people who live under real oppression have no need to fabulate oppression. I think he means fabricate. To paraphrase Madge from the old Palmolive ads, they're already soaking in it. Second, when you live in an oppressive country, there's no one you can take your grievances to because that is what it means to live in an oppressive country. If you're an inmate in Shawshank Prison, you can't go to the guards and complain. When you live in North Korea, you can't go to the local police and gripe about your work conditions or the sawdust in your bread. And this was the case that I was making last week in regards to this. Is we've gotten to a point in this country where it's actually perceived as a value to be a victim, where it's actually currency. I mean, that's why, by his own admission, according to the reports we've gotten from the police in Chicago, his motive in doing this was because he was upset that he wasn't getting paid enough for his role in Empire. So inherent in that motive is, If I paint myself as the victim of a hate crime, it's going to up my currency. It's going to be a bullet point on my resume. Hey, you know, spent this much time at Juilliard, spent this much time in these roles in various productions. Oh, and by the way, victim of a hate crime, right? Which, when you go to sit down to negotiate your contract, is apparently going to be of value. I mean, he at least seems to think so. And, you know, to Goldberg's point here, how is it possible that we live in a society where there's genuine, actual oppression and we're actually living under a condition of white supremacy and, you know, white privilege and all these things that are alleged all the time? If that's true, if you actually can leverage victim status to your benefit.
It would be too bad if you could leverage your victim status to your own benefits. I think that we don't want to go down that road as a community. But one thing that I was thinking about, and sometimes when I'm in the studio just listening to you, sometimes I forget that I'm in a studio listening to you. I'm not just a listener at home on the radio, so I have to reply. But I was taking some notes. You know, it's kind of like when they say, well, gun violence. Isn't it just violence? Or when he files a false police report, isn't that just fraud? Or isn't it just a crime in general? And so when I look at these racially charged or emotionally triggered hate crimes that are false reporting, or the lady that burnt down her own house, I feel bad for the people that do fall victim, that are victims of these crimes. And it's not necessarily because it's a gay hate crime, but it's just a bad crime that has happened to them. And the reason why these triggered emotional, you know, racial hate crimes are bringing more emotion to it is because it's following this social justice restoration of our society and our community. And I just feel really bad that it's taken away from the people that really have had these things happen to them. And that one police chief said, how does a black man in Chicago use a noose around his neck and fake it? Like, it's just very disrespectful to the way things used to be and the crimes that, or the hate crimes that used to actually happen. I think this is just a down a bad road. And I've actually watched Empire. I've seen the show and I kind of know what he's about. And I go to think from him, and I go think about like how Roseanne was kicked off her show.
Right.
And I'm really interested to see how Hollywood or the celebrity class treats this situation.
He's still got a job.
Well, we're going to find out, you know, what's going to happen. I've read articles that he maybe his show time goes down. And
to your point with Roseanne, we didn't have to wait to see
it happened right away
within 24 hours. Within 24 hours. And this is something, you know, this Matt Walsh had a tweet to this effect as well. He listed the governor in Virginia, I think it is, who was had the whole blackface incident. He still got a job because he's a Democrat, right? And he just kind of went down the list of when it's leftists of prominence. And we've talked about this in the past, that there's this kind of formula that's in play of what's your political utility. And if you have greater political utility as a victim or as an activist or as an example or a rallying point, then you'll survive any controversy. And then that's why Harvey Weinstein was so up in arms. He's like, why are you guys turning against me? Haven't I donated enough money to liberal causes? Well, yeah, but it wasn't enough to cover
that.
Yeah. Closing argument, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can contribute to the program, 651-989-5855. Brianne taking those calls and producing the show for the vacationing Brad. Appreciate having her here. Also in studio, Xavier Bickett, chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus in Minnesota. He just came in unannounced.
I just was like, hey, what are you doing tonight?
He just kicked the door open and took a seat, and I haven't kicked him out yet.
No, so. I miss Brad because he usually has some good intro music for me. We got to get in on this.
Was that a dig on Brad?
Everyone loves my intro music. So I don't know what you're talking about.
No, I have my own, though.
Oh, shit. You guys could have that.
This is top of the hour music, right? Yeah, there's no argument about that.
Yeah. You're not going to get very far. She controls the microphones, by the way, just so you know.
I noticed my mic off.
That's great. All right. So there's a number of articles here that, you know, at first glance, if you were just to look at the headlines, you really wouldn't necessarily see a common thread or a common theme between them all. But the reason why I've grouped them together and I want to kind of thumb through them here with you, Xavier, is the theme that I see, the through line that I see is what I call the anti-life left, which is a little bit redundant because in my view, the left is inherently anti-life. They're anti-progress. They're anti-human productivity. Basically, the reverse of everything they claim to be for. And these articles really demonstrate it. I mean, I think when you point to an example like Venezuela, where all of the ideas that are commonly put forward by various leftist personages here in the United States have actually been acted upon and have gone through to their logical fruition and resulted in the devastation of that country. I mean, that should be the open and shut case, right? Like you look at it, you're like, okay, here's a country, and that's just the most recent example. Forget about history, right? Mm-hmm. 150 years of history we can look at, but you look at this example of a country that has actually followed the path or gone down the path of what they prescribe, and that ought to be your red flag waving you off of adopting these crazy ideas, and yet it's not.
Shouldn't that be the example of this is what we should not be doing? They've tried it. It doesn't work. Don't they have vast natural resources? I got to figure out what my South America places.
Yeah.
I thought they did. And then the government came in to try and control it, and it just went horribly wrong. Like, wasn't there no bread on the shelves and
people eating their dogs and people starving? And yeah. Well, and here's the thing. So it's a catastrophe, right? Venezuela is Venezuelans, people who live there, separating the people from their government.
Sure.
The people are suffering, and that suffering naturally triggers and initiates sympathy, empathy, charity. And so people are opening up their wallets, opening up their hearts, trying to engage, trying to help out by sending aid to Venezuela. The response, as reported by CNN, on February 23rd, humanitarian aid will enter Venezuela one way or another, the country's self-declared president, Juan Guaido, declared earlier this month. But not so fast, President Nicolas Maduro, who won re-election in a widely contested or criticized vote last year, has promised to block the supplies. And organizers, including the Red Cross and United Nations, have refused to help. Now, what long and short of this, why it's happening, Maduro doesn't want to let aid into the country to help the people that live there.
It makes him look bad, I would
say. Right. Right. And this is something that there's a lesson to be learned in this for all of us. The left will, and it goes back to the Smollett thing we were talking about last segment. There are still people who are acting like, you know, there's nothing to see there. And acting as though, no, it's, and even to the extent that they're acknowledging, okay, maybe he faked it. Yeah, but it's still indicative of a real problem in our country, and we need to be focused on ending the hate, right? And pushing back against the white supremacy or whatever. They go right back to their narrative. These people will never, ever, under any circumstances, admit that they're wrong. Even when the result of their policies is death in the streets, people starving to death, eating dogs, right? Like, no matter how bad it gets in a place like Venezuela, they're not going to admit that they're wrong. For Maduro to accept aid would be to admit that the policies under Hugo Chavez and the policies that he supports and the ideology that he holds is not working for the people of Venezuela. And saving face, which it doesn't, that's the thing, is it doesn't even save face. There isn't a single person anywhere who's fooled by this, right? Well, maybe there's
maybe
one.
Maybe I was going to say.
Maybe there's one. Bernie Sanders, as reported by the IGR, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, declined an opportunity to call Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro a dictator, despite acknowledging his abuses and the lack of free elections in the country. And it goes on to cite the specific exchange he had with a reporter where he was pushed to acknowledge that Maduro was in fact a dictator and that things are horrible in Venezuela, and he refused to do
so. Well, you know why, right? Because then it's going to make him have to backtrack on some of the socialist policies that he is pushing,
right,
to show that, hey, these aren't working in Venezuela. So it's better just to deflect than when people admit that they're actually wrong about their policies. And if he would go to say, one, that yes, he is a dictator and they're suffering because of socialist policies, well, then his whole presidency campaign is going to completely fail. We'll see what happens. But he raised a bunch of money in like 2 days. Did you see that? It was like $4-6 million.
Well, and this is just it. I think for me, the bottom line takeaway of the fact that, you know, Maduro won't let aid into the country.
That's bad.
Bernie Sanders won't call him a dictator. And we've seen other examples where no matter how often the left is proven wrong, they won't admit to it. They just double down on their policies. The lesson for conservatives, and here's another opportunity for me to get you in trouble as somebody who is working within the Republican Party and actually has to liaison with the likes of the Senate caucus and the House caucus and what have you. You know, we had Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka in here last week, and we talked with him about the tactics and the strategy that Republicans utilize in both their electoral and legislative pursuits. And he put forward his lived experience of the period between 2010 and 2012, where, of course, Republicans swept into power in 2010, retook the Senate for the first time in like 40 years, and, you know, the villagers celebrated, right? And then the next two years, they, as he characterized it, took bold, decisive action, engaged in all kinds of reforms, things like one of the things he cited was sunsetting regulations. We put in regulations that automatically sunset. Now, I agree with that. I think that's a good thing. I don't know that anybody was really, you know,
cheering for that,
dancing in the streets because they were sunsetting regulations.
Thanks for ending your own regulations.
But yeah, right. Yeah, right. I mean, it's a good thing. Absolutely should happen. I don't know how controversial it was. But at any rate, in 2012, Republicans lost in this state, as they frequently do.
Mm-hmm.
And the lesson, apparently, as according to Gazelka, that the incumbency took from that loss was, we were too bold, we overreached, we did too much, and so now we have to be smarter. We have to realize that we're in a purple state at best, and more likely a blue state. It's a Democrat state for a long time, and we need to realize that Minnesota nice is a thing that plays into the dynamic here, and we have to act accordingly.
So there are some things of advice of wisdom I will concede to is, Republican brand, Republican platform is different around the country, and it is also different within our own state. Republican suburbans, Republican inner city Republicans, and outstate Republicans, they may have different values that are important to them based off their lifestyle that they're living. But I think some of the major principles and some of the major values that we all share is this limited government value. And to say that, you know, we have to realize we're in a purple state, I don't think that means you should concede on your values and principles. I think that if I was a leader, which I'm not, but in that realm, is I would try and push forward the values and the principles of limited government and try to solve those problems without the force and use of government, instead of parading, we're in a purple state, we have to do this, and then sunset my own regulation or sunset my own government program. It's a very frustrating path to take. And you know, I'm not in his shoes, and I don't know what the negotiations or the compromise that go on, but I don't know if I would tout that as a victory or something that I would, you know, elect me again as a leader because I want to do it again.
I, you know, when you sit across from somebody in a scenario like this, in a setting like we're sitting right now, you're looking somebody in the eye, you get a sense of their sincerity. And I have no doubt that the Senate Majority Leader is entirely sincere in both his perception of his own experience and the experience of his caucus and his cohort there in St. Paul, and also in the desire to put forward a good face to the public of, hey, we care about people. Hey, we're Minnesota nice. But here's what I'm getting to, and it ties back into the whole situation with Venezuela and with Bernie Sanders' inability to acknowledge the reality of what's taking place there, and Maduro's unwillingness to let aid in because it won't save face, and it indicates that there's something wrong with his ideas. First of all, point number one, the left is not Minnesota nice. Hmm. The left is not any kind of nice. It is not nice to starve people to death. It is not nice to stand between two people who want to engage in relationship. It's not nice to set prices, to tell people that they can't work at a price that they're willing to work at, to regulate people, to mandate people, to tax people. None of this is nice, and it doesn't result in nice outcomes. And that's the angle. Look, I'm all for embracing Minnesota nice as a concept, but your task in that context is to demonstrate that the Democrats are not nice. In fact, they're horrible. They are terrible people who should not have power. And you know, one of the ways you could demonstrate that is by the fact that they never acknowledge when they're wrong. You know who's always apologizing in the public discourse? Conservatives, Republicans. You know, somebody gets accused of saying something that's racist or sexist or offended somebody or whatever the case may be. They come out and they apologize, but only if they're a Republican, only if they're a conservative. You know who never apologizes? Anybody on the left for anything ever.
Ilhan apologized one time.
But it's never.
It's not. It wasn't real.
Yeah. It's always couched in the, yeah, but I'm actually right. Right. You know, and the fact of the matter is, and this is my bottom line takeaway, we need to realize, and by we, I mean everybody who's not a leftist, regardless of where you fall, libertarian, conservative, Republican, I don't care, normal people, what we have to realize is that the left will never win them over with an argument. We are not going to win this argument. The only victory we're ever going to be able to obtain is political victory, electoral victory. We have to defeat them utterly. They have to be dragged out of power. They have to be denied the capacity to put their ideas into action. They're never going to get to the point where we present them with enough evidence. Venezuela, they're never going to get to the point where we present them with an argument that convinces them that they're wrong, because they're not dealing in argument. They're not dealing in reality. They are dealing in a Nietzschean will, a conviction to power. They just want the control because, as I've talked about many times before, they have this inverted sense of where happiness comes from. In their minds, happiness is not self-generated. It's not something that you generate for yourself with your own values. It's something that is created for you by the world that you live in. And if everybody else isn't doing what they're supposed to do, then you can't be happy. Well, if that's your way of looking at the world, then your only means toward happiness is by controlling everyone else, by becoming Maduro, by becoming a dictator. And it's a terrible, that is not Minnesota nice. And it should be very, very easy to make that case. And I don't understand why Republicans don't see that and don't act upon it.
Well, how is it being Minnesota nice telling people what to do and telling people how to live their life? Isn't Minnesota nice kind of like the passive, like, oh, well, you can go first, or, you know, you can live the life the way libertarian is the nice, you know,
right?
You do you, I'm going to do me. And as long as we're not infringing on each other, then the world is a happy butterfly place. And, you know, you bring up a good point where, you know, Democrats aren't nice. How is it nice when they're always trying to legislate your life and tell you what to do all the time? That's not Minnesota nice.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. My name's Walter Hudson. Closing Arguments, the name of the program. We'll be back with Xavier Bickett, chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus of Minnesota. You can join us as well, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Xavier Bickett in studio, chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus of Minnesota. My name is Walter Hudson. Closing Argument is the program. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Appreciate you guys joining us. You can contribute 651-989-5855. The lines are open. We've been talking about the anti-life nature of the left. I mean, that really is in principle where they're coming from. They are against life in every conceivable way. Like, literally, we'll get to this bill that just passed in Vermont about abortion straight up until the moment of birth, just like the New York one. This is apparently their preemptive strike against what they perceive to be the imminent overturn of Roe versus Wade, which, of course, there is no imminent overturn of Roe versus Wade. Like, that's not happening. There's no indication that it's going to happen. There's been no movement from pro-life circles or from Republicans anywhere to that effect. So I don't know where this fear is coming from, but they're leveraging the perceived fear of this coming down by being like, well, we better get ahead of it and start passing laws in these states that just expand access. This is literally what they're saying. Expand access to abortion as much as we possibly can in anticipation of that.
How do you campaign on that? How do you campaign on, we're going to make it so that you can have an abortion up until the birth of the child? Like, how do you run on that? I don't understand how do you say you're proud of that? How do you campaign and give a campaign stump speech and get cheers for that? I've thought about this life abortion issue recently, actually, because it kind of ties into some anti-vax stuff, you know, the vaccinations, the stuff that's going on at the legislature now. And I'm thinking to myself, someone is literally campaigning, is like, I'm going to let you guys have abortions up until the birth of the child, and we're going to allow you to kill babies. Like, how is that your campaign message? It scares me a little bit, a lot of it, but.
Well, I think the answer to, you know, how is this something that has traction in the culture? How is this a winning political message, even from within the Democratic Party? Because I'm old enough to remember when the line from Bill Clinton was, we want abortions to be safe, legal, and rare, which nowadays he would be drummed out of the party for saying that. Right? Like, that's not good enough. The new standard is we need to expand access as much as humanly possible. And you got the guy in, I think it was Virginia, the same one who got in trouble for blackface.
Oh, man.
Got in trouble for blackface the week before he was saying that, well, you know, if you want to kill the kid after it's been born, that's okay, too. Wasn't in trouble for that. So, you know, to your question of how is it that this is the point that we find ourselves in the culture, I think we have a indication of the answer from I was going to say unlikely source, but this is a very likely source. The connection between abortion and this may not be immediately clear, but it is there, and we'll explain after we play this clip from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in her kitchen.
Our planet is going to face disaster if we don't turn the ship around. And so it's basically like there's scientific consensus that the lives of children are going to be very difficult. And it does lead, I think, young people to have a legitimate question. You know, is it okay to still have children? And, I mean, not just financially, because people are graduating with $20,000, $30,000, $100,000 worth of student loan debt, and so they can't even afford to have kids in a house, but also just this basic moral question, like, what do we do? And even if you don't have kids, there are still children here in the world, and we have a moral obligation to them.
So that last statement is the seed of their own demise, because in spite of everything, in spite of their anti-life message and their anti-life priorities and their anti-life platform, they are still trying to appeal to the concept of posterity. They are still trying to appeal to the concept of there's a tomorrow and there's going to be people who you care about who are going to live in that tomorrow, and we should be taking action in order to make the world a better place for them. That's their Achilles heel, because in point of fact, just like with the Minnesota Nice stuff, their policies are going to do the opposite, right? And it's demonstrated right there in her own rhetoric, because she's saying that climate change is so bad and the Death Star has entered orbit and Thanos is about to snap and we're all going to die because of climate change. So you should really think hard about whether or not you're going to have children
or not.
Now, it's in that context that I find resonance with what just passed in Vermont and what just passed in New York. These abortion laws that say, well, you can decide up until the moment you have the kid that you're not, that you're not ready for it. But also, if you've thought long and hard and you've done some yoga and some meditation and you've come to the conclusion that it's not morally right to bring a child into a world where Thanos is about to snap and or where the Death Star is about to fire, or where, you know, where climate change is about to light the seas on fire or freeze them or whichever direction climate change is swinging nowadays. I don't know. It changes from day to day. But if that's your mentality, that this fatalistic notion that we're on a course to disaster, it facilitates a kind of anti-life orientation. And make no mistake, if you are coming from a paradigm that prescribes not having children, you're obviously anti-life, right? I mean, that's how civilizations die, by not reproducing, children. Right? Like, we're all mortal. We're all going to die. If the civilization is going to continue, you need to have kids.
What I don't understand is, why aren't these thoughts and these doubts about having children coming to when you're cuddling up watching, you know, Netflix and chill? Like, why is this thought process happening, you know, so late in this pregnancy and so late in this process of whether or not to have this child? I don't understand why this thought process isn't happening when you're cuddling with someone and you're about to make those next steps.
Right.
Like, I know that's probably not at the top of your list, but you would think, all right, I need to get my condom today. We need to have birth control pills or whatever the case is. Or even after you find out you're pregnant, man, I shouldn't be bringing a kid into this world now.
Why does it take you 8 months and 29 days?
What changed in those 8 months? Thank you for finishing my set. Thank you. Yeah. What took so long? Why are you waiting so long to make this decision? It's kind of disappointing when you hear politicians or leaders allow this type of thought process to happen and to promote it and to campaign on it, when I would love to see them campaign on, you know, if Planned Parenthood really was about preventative pregnancy and life choices, and they actually focused on preventing, you know, the sperm and egg meeting instead of destroying life, I would give them more kudos, and it's just not the way it's going. It's very disappointing.
You know what the original Planned Parenthood was?
What?
Judeo-Christian morality. You know how you plan your parenthood? You control when and where you have sex. Pretty easy. Pretty foolproof. Works 100% of the time with no flaws. Right? That's Planned Parenthood. They have, just like with everything, they have co-opted a legitimate concept and they've bastardized it. They've corrupted it. They've turned it into the opposite of what it actually is. Like, Planned Parenthood, like, it should be called Unplanned Parenthood. Because that's what it is, right? It's the place you go when, oops, I didn't plan to be a parent. So now I'm going to kill my kid. Like, that's, it is, like with everything the left does, 180 degrees the opposite of what it's purported to be. Xavier Bickett in studio with us, as usual, regretting his choice to come in. Walter Hudson, closing argument, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. A listener sent this while we were talking about Bernie Sanders and the situation in Venezuela. There was reporting that Maduro, the dictator there, was refusing aid to enter the country because, of course, he's trying to save face, which is ludicrous because, you know, there's literally nobody. There's not a single person who's like, oh, I guess things must be great in Venezuela because Maduro said no to humanitarian aid. Like, that's not a way to argue a point, but that's just how stubborn. That's the nature of the evil that we're dealing with. We're such incredible intransigence that it defies any sort of logic whatsoever. Well, apparently, and this is from the Daily Wire, self-declared socialist Bernie Sanders got blasted by his followers on Twitter this weekend after tweeting out lukewarm support for humanitarian efforts aimed at citizens of Venezuela and encouraging another socialist Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to allow shipments of food and medical supplies to enter the country. So he tweets out that, yeah, Maduro should let in the supplies, and his supporters come after him. The leftist base comes after Sanders. Why? You know what their reasoning was, what their rationale is?
Mm-mm.
You're advancing the narrative of Trump. The narrative, listen, when I say the left is anti-life, I am not joking. This is not political hyperbole. I'm not trying to get listens. I'm not trying to provoke interest in what we're talking about on the radio. I am being factually accurate. They are anti-life. To value a political narrative above human life is about as evil as you can get, right? And that's what we're dealing with. That's how you get to Venezuela. And these are the people. And, you know, Bernie Sanders is one thing. Maduro is one thing. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one thing. The people we really need to be worried about are the voters. There is a market for this stuff, and it is growing. We have an entire contingency of our friends and neighbors who live in this state, this country, and This is one of the things, and I know this will resonate with you, Xavier. We're talking with Xavier Bickett in studio. He's the chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus in Minnesota. There's all this rhetoric, particularly from our side, from Republicans right now, about the threat of immigrants and immigration and refugees. You know, the Somalis are coming, the Mexicans are coming, you know, run for the hills. The Somalis aren't going to take down the United States of America, all right? I got news for you. The Mexicans aren't what's going to rot our republic from within. It's us. It's our friends, our neighbors, people who were born here, people who are buying into these poisonous ideas that are going to destroy the remnant of liberty in our country. And, you know, I find myself deeply, deeply concerned about it. One person who's not concerned about it is a gentleman by the name of Daniel McCarthy, who writes over at Spectator. He had a piece, Why Libertarians Are Wrong.
Mm.
And I had you thumb through this a little bit during the breaks. And, you know, we're not gonna read from it. We're not going to quote from it because it's kind of a meandering, really bizarre, not particularly cogent piece of writing. But the summary of it is basically that he's arguing that libertarians don't have answers to economic utility and political utility in what he would refer to as the real world, that libertarians don't have real world solutions to problems such as what do you do about a shrinking middle class? What do you do about China rising on the international stage? What do you do about Islam rising in Europe and potentially becoming a force and taking over the planet? Libertarians don't have an answer to this. There's no way to deal with these realities in the world. And completely missing from his analysis as I read it is any consideration of this thing called justice, this thing called individual rights. Because it's to me, it's indicative of the fact, and I'd be interested in getting your take on this, Xavier, yep, as somebody who's active in advocating for liberty.
Yes.
It's indicative of where our public discourse is stuck. Our public discourse is stuck on the question of utility, of what's going to work in order to achieve the end that I want to achieve. How am I going to create jobs? How am I going to lower healthcare costs? How am I going to expand access to education and expand access to healthcare and retirement benefits? And when that's where you start is with the question of how do I achieve X, then the consideration of rights and justice and process are going to go completely out the window. Because you know what stands in the way of your objectives? Other people, as it turns out. When I'm trying to get from here to home, there's a whole lot of property in between that it would, if I was going to take a straight line, it would be a whole lot quicker if I could just bulldoze across everybody's property from here to where I want to go. But they have rights, and so I can't do that.
Yes. Well, when I, the article you sent me, there was one quote that I really liked. If we just cut taxes and deregulate hair braiding, the market will take care of the rest.
Yeah, that's his characterization.
I thought it was really, and but it, you know, it does fill this stereotype of the libertarian, right? Of why libertarians are wrong is because, well, you just let it be a free for all and everything will collapse. But that's not necessarily what the libertarian philosophy or libertarian defenders or defenders of liberty are about. It's defending the individual liberty. Now, I will say, there is a point to be made of why libertarians or people that believe in limited governments are don't always govern the best, because they don't believe government should be doing it. But there is something we need more from liberty leaders, is finding solutions and building coalitions and bringing people together to solve problems. It's a lot easier as a politician or a legislator to just write a new tax, write a new law, and force everyone to do it, right? That's so easy. That's what makes, you know, this government, this, you know, authoritative government works so easy. That's a lot easier to do than to be a leader or a legislator that says, let's try and solve this problem by bringing, you know, this business to provide training for these people that we see the market's going to have this need in the future. You can do it without forcing people to come together. You can do it by being a leader. And I don't think we have enough libertarian leaders that have that charisma and have that inspiration for people. And I think that's kind of where we fall short. I had this actually libertarian philosophy debate at this last at this meeting tonight with the NAACP Political Action Committee. And we always stick around after meeting. We debate libertarian philosophy. We have a fun time doing it. And he said, and one of the gentlemen said, you know, I love how you defend liberty and you're always trying to make the case for liberty. And I said, yes, because I would rather have the inconveniences of too much liberty than not having enough of it. And I think that was a Thomas Jefferson quote, right? Yeah, I understand there's going to be inconveniences of liberty, but I would rather have the inconveniences of too much liberty than not enough of it. And I really try and say that to people, because everyone wants to live free, or everyone believes in liberty when it comes to their own personal liberty, but they're so quick to say, oh, but you need to really act this way, or I'm willing to allow the government to force you to act a certain way. And that's where someone has to stand up for those people.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think also there is, and this, as you say, falls back upon libertarians and advocates, self-prescribed or self-professed advocates of individual rights, to perform this responsibility, is to do a better job of defining what liberty even means. I mean, what do we even mean when we talk about individual rights? What do we even mean when we talk about liberty? And in particular, when this author at Spectator gets into talking about foreign policy and the threat of China and the threat of Islam, or whatever threat you want to point to, to the extent it actually is a threat, and what do we mean by threat? Just that they might do better than us in some economic area or another, that's a threat? Or do we mean that they're going to encroach upon our individual rights? If we mean they're going to encroach upon our individual rights, well, we have an answer to that, and it's a libertarian answer.
Yes.
And the answer is military action, right? Like, actual threats against actual liberty should be dealt with in a military manner. But militarism as a kind of utilitarian process for achieving ends that have nothing whatsoever to do with the individual rights of your citizens, that creates more problems than it solves.
Yeah, and when it comes to that, it's easy to say, oh, well, if we just have this free market or we just have liberty, things fall apart or someone else is going to become more powerful. And I think the people that love to govern, or the people that love to tell other people what to do, I don't find their leadership inspiring. And I think that's where, like I had said before, libertarians fall short, is we need someone who is willing to find a way to solve problems without using the force of government. And maybe those leaders aren't in government. Maybe they are in the private sector, creating products, creating services, to solve these problems without the role of government. But I think we still need those liberty, the defenders of liberty in our government to say, okay, these taxes or these regulations are going a little bit too far. And those are the people that we're trying to, with the Republican Liberty Caucus, to put into office, and bills we're trying to push forward or fight against.
Xavier Bickett in studio with us with the Republican Liberty Caucus of Minnesota. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Twin Cities News Talk. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson.
And I'm Xavier Bickett.
Thank you, Xavier, for sparing me the burden of having to say your name. Chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus of Minnesota. Appreciate you coming in, making things easier for me on a Monday. It's always great to have that support and to get your perspective. Now, as it turns out, you're actually bringing topics into the program as well.
I did.
There's a bill that you guys are working on or working against.
Working against. You know, and I should have brought this up earlier, but I kind of completely forgot because I'm doing so many things. There's a bill right now called Senate File 1520. And what it does is it removes exemptions from immunizations. So currently the way the law is if a notarized statement signed by the minor, child's parent or guardian, or the emancipated person is submitted to the administrator or other person having general control, the supervision of the school or child care facility stating that the person has not been immunized. Thank you. Yeah. As prescribed in subdivision one, blah, blah, blah. Basically, if a parent shows up with a note or gives their child a note that's signed, says this, they don't have to have this immunization shot. And so currently this bill, what it's doing is it's taking away that personal exemption. And so the Republican Liberty Caucus and many liberty-minded people are against this bill, removing this personal exemption. And one of the reasons, I just want to cite something from one of our board members. We're going to probably be issuing this press release this week. Starting in 1986, vaccine manufacturers have been free from liability for any vaccine injuries caused by recommended vaccines. It's an unprecedented act of corporate welfare that the companies sought because Congress declared vaccines to be unavoidably safe. And so, like, when I thought, and I didn't even know about this, but companies, they are free from any liability from the vaccines they give children if it causes any bodily harm or injury to them. So they, like, there is no liability. Like, the free market response would be if you give a vaccine and they're injured, then you should be able to sue and they're liable.
Right.
Well, they lose this liability. And so since then, Minnesota parents have had the right to opt out of these liability-free vaccine recommendations based on their own religious or philosophical objections, or all of these reasons. Not only does this bill take away those rights, it gives Minnesota the most coercive public health policy in the United States. And if I may continue, we think that parents should be able to make decisions on the basis of their knowledge of the health of their children, their understanding of the science of vaccine safety, or their religious beliefs, and that vaccines both individually and in a combination have never been subjected to the rigorous safety studies that pharmaceutical drugs must face, and there's a robust scientific debate about many vaccine safety questions. And so what we're just saying is if you want to have a vaccine, great. We're not taking away your right to be vaccinated. If vaccines will prevent any illness to your kid and you want to do that, go for it. But you should still be allowed to, as a parent or as an individual, opt out of it as the current law stands. So we oppose this bill to change that.
Yeah, it's astounding to me that, because look, you know, just to kind of cut to the chase, because I don't want people to think that this is suddenly an anti-vaxxer show. We haven't talked about it. We haven't talked about vaccinations between ourselves, but I'm not an anti-vax person. My kids are vaccinated.
My kid's vax. I just had a kid. He's one. We just got his yearly five shots, which was a horrible day. You know,
I've kept up with my own, you know, like to me, it's not a question. The issue of being for or against a vaccination is entirely beside the point. This is about, as you put it, the freedom to act upon your own judgment, first and foremost, just human liberty. But beyond that, the fact that you by taking this path of coercion, you're actually subverting the natural process, the natural market process by which these harmful effects are prevented to a large degree. And corrected. I think more importantly, corrected. What incentive does a vaccine company have to get it right, so to speak, if they can't be sued?
There's no liability.
And if their product is mandated to be consumed
by the government.
Right. Like, then you have no incentive at all to ensure that your vaccine does what it says it's going to do.
And it's not that they're doing these to be negative or malice or neglect.
Right, exactly.
But you should still be held liable if something bad happens.
It's the moral hazard. Any time that you remove the responsibility, the liability from a party to act appropriately, to act properly, to take the precautions they should take, corners are naturally going to be cut, because it turns out that people are, when anybody takes any kind of action in the market or outside of the market, you know, under a coercive environment, there are certain factors that they're weighing against each other: cost, profit, you know, quality, reputation, brand, personal moral values and code. What the government does when it comes in and mandates things and sets prices and removes liability and artificially adjusts the wires and flips the switches and changes the calculus is it changes the environment in which people are making their decisions. So even though they might not be setting up, they don't wake up in the morning like some sort of comic book villain thinking, how many kids can I give autism to today, right? Like, even though that's not where they're coming from, they still might end up making bad decisions because the environment has been altered in an artificial way to facilitate things moving in that direction. Very much appreciate Xavier Bickett, chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus, coming in and joining us.
Thanks for letting me crash the show.
Anytime. You know, you can always kick open the door and take a seat. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. My name's Walter Hudson. Closing argument. We'll be here again tomorrow, 8 to 10.